Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to SEAC Stories, brought to you by the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre at the University of Sydney. This podcast tells the stories of our members. I'm your host, Natalie Pearson. Globally, 1.4 billion people are considered to be financially excluded, meaning they cannot safely access appropriate and affordable financial services. Muslim communities have particularly high levels of financial exclusion. For example, Muslim-majority countries have 24% lower participation rates in active borrowing from banks and 29% lower rates of bank account ownership compared to other countries. In Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim-majority country, the vast majority of financial enterprises are classified as small to medium enterprises and lack access to capital in the same way as larger corporations. Outgoing President Joko Widodo has actively sought to promote Islamic finance-based development initiatives through both grassroots support of Islamic microfinance as well as top-down policy support. To discuss financial access and socio-economic development in Indonesia, I'm joined by Dr. Tanvir Udin, founder and CEO of Wholesome, an impact-focused investment platform that enables investors to support socio-economic development through a global portfolio of small and medium-sized enterprise and microfinance investments. Tanvir's thesis, which he completed at the Sydney Law School, examined the intersection of law and development through the prism of Islamic microfinance programs in Indonesia and Bangladesh. His research interests include Islamic finance, fintech startups, development, and sustainability. Welcome, Tanvir.
Thank you so much, Natalie, for having me.
So nice to have you on the podcast. We've been waiting for you to finish your PhD so we could get you along. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So your research sits at the intersection of law and development. Can you tell us more about how Islamic microfinance fits within that broader context of law and development?
Yeah, absolutely. So Islamic microfinance, which is a subset of the broader Islamic banking and finance industry, is really a regulatory instrument because there are rules and regulations that an institution must follow to be able to comply with Islamic law. And so what got me interested was to understand, okay, if it is a law-based system, how does the broader social and political landscape influence how that is operated? And does it actually ensure the compliance that's required by the participants?
So tell us more about what Islamic finance is in a general sense, not specific to Indonesia, but how does it differ from conventional financing initiatives?
Yeah, sure. So essentially there's sort of two sort of aspects to it. The first is that Muslim communities, by their religious beliefs and practices, avoid certain industries. So an Islamic finance institution or Islamic finance transactions cannot participate in activities such as alcohol, pig products, and a few others. So that's the first sort of exclusion. The second thing is that from a consideration of monetary transactions, Islamic law prohibits the participation in any interest-bearing transactions, as well as transactions that have very high levels of risk and uncertainty. So these are two terms called riba and gharar. And so an Islamic finance institution tries to get around this, but still provide a profit or a revenue stream for a financier. So the typical case would be, well, the most standard one that's also using conventional is just taking up a joint venture or two or more parties come together. But in Islamic finance, when you have a debt-based transaction where someone needs to borrow money, instead of just saying, here's $100, pay me back $110, it will be required that they would need to have an asset or they would need to lease something, they would need to sell it at a profit. So other ways to get around that interest. And basically the crux of the matter is, and what was relevant in my thesis, was to understand how microfinance had gotten a lot of bad press over the last couple of decades. And one of the key issues was the burdensome debts that a lot of really poor farmers or shopkeepers had taken. And so I was interested to look at, well, Islamic microfinance tries to avoid that. Does it really achieve some of those better objectives? And how does it actually do that? And what are the challenges in trying to implement it?
So tell us your findings. What did you find in Bangladesh and Indonesia? Did the poor reputation of Islamic microfinance bear out in the research that you conducted?
Yeah, so kind of just put the context, there's been three major scholarly critiques of the global microfinance industry, which would include Islamic microfinance. The first is that a lot of the borrowers ended up taking up too much debt and they became very saddled by debt that they couldn't pay back. And some of the worst cases of that were there was a lot of farmer suicides in India that got a lot of press. The other critique has been that a lot of institutions started to enact very forceful collection strategies, everything from humiliating borrowers to taking control of their assets to make sure that they repaid. And then the third element had been that the interest rates or the financing costs just absolutely exorbitant. There was reports in Mexico, for example, that they were high as 200%. And in many other countries, it's usually in the 30 to 100% range. So when I looked at the Islamic microfinance institutions, and I did some field work with four institutions, two in each country and of a different nature, some were NGO-based, some were more sort of commercial-based. What I found was that in practice, the institutions did try and go out of their way to try and be as lenient as possible. So they definitely didn't compound any interest. So when usually an institution, if you fail to pay, they will charge you interest on your original principal plus the amount that you haven't paid yet, and it just keeps snowballing. So that practice wasn't there. The other thing I saw was that borrowers, whether they were Muslim or not, because they did have non-Muslim clients, the thing that attracted them to the Islamic institution, more than just saying, oh, this is Sharia compliant, this is in line with my values, the reason they really got excited and they stayed with them was because they were so compassionate and lenient with their payment terms. And that was a defining feature. And so that was one thing. The other thing was all majority of institutions did require that when they borrowed money, it was linked to a physical asset. And that was actually significant because there is a requirement from religious law about that. But from a practical perspective, it meant that borrowers weren't just taking money and going off on spending it on intoxicants or other sorts of less productive activities. They were typically using it for farming or shopkeeping, or they had to pay certain expenses. And so that kind of restricted the amount of capital that was delivered. There is some criticisms of Islamic microfinance in that it's too small. It's not as prolific as the conventional. But this is one of the reasons, but also the other side of it is it restricts the risk of overburdening borrowers as well.
Yeah, well, when you put it like that, it does sound quite ethical, doesn't it?
Yes.
How do the banks make any money?
Yeah, so we've got, interestingly, it ends up being sort of a multi-tiered system. So a lot of the institutions that are working with the poorest segments tend to be more philanthropic in nature, or they tend to be NGO-based, and they might combine some of their loans on a more commercial basis combined with social funding that they receive from other members and so forth. So in Indonesia, it's really interesting. So the most common type of Islamic microfinance institution is a structure called the Baitul Mal wa Tamwil. The Baitul Mal wa Tamwil, or the BMT, they have many variants. They have variants based on geography as well as even, for example, affiliation with other religious institutions. So the two Islamic mass organizations, Muhammadiyya and Nahdlatul Ulama, they are the largest patrons of Islamic microfinance institutions compared to sort of other independent groups. And so there's a lot of social capital that's sort of being funneled through and that subsidizes some of the lower segments. The more commercial tiers, if you look about larger, small and medium enterprises or even corporates, they do make commercial returns. And that's, again, they are pricing their products using other mechanisms, whether it be a financial lease structure or whether it be profit sharing. So they can still kind of make their money from that way. What my focus was more on that sort of micro space and looking at the most vulnerable. And so I concluded that when they do integrate with the other philanthropic organizations' activities, it does allow to a way to address the ethical concerns. And this was perhaps what's missing in the conventional. Because just to kind of add, in Bangladesh, you've got a lot of Muslim majority country, but the majority of the most prominent institutions, and everyone may know about Muhammad Yunus, he won the Nobel Prize for microfinance and microcredit in 2006. His institution is not Islamic. So they use interest-bearing transactions and they are not linked to the Islamic social philanthropic scene in the same way. So an interesting contrast there.
Well, that's a good segue to my next question, which is about Islamic financing being more widely adopted, including by both the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, which are now introducing Islamic financing transactions. Why has it been more widely adopted now? Is it because of this more ethical component or because it's more effective?
Yeah, there's a number of interesting trends that have been operating. So earlier you were asking about why I was looking at law and development. So there's been interesting scholarly pushback against the modus operandi of a lot of these large organizations like the World Bank and the IMF over the last couple of decades. So in the 40s and 50s, there's a push towards modernization based on, let's just adopt Western institutions. fast forward in the 90s and 2000s, a lot of scholars, particularly out in the US, started to say, well, we've been sort of co-opting law just as an input to the broader neoliberal economic thinking that everything should move like efficient markets. And a lot of scholars from a wide variety of disciplines started to push back and say that, well, there are a lot of indigenous legal systems and customs that actually add a lot of value in the development process. And there's culturally appropriate ways to do things as well. And so in came these new scholars starting to criticize the old ways and start to co-opt local legal traditions. And so one of them was Islamic banking and finance as something that's inherent within Islamic societies. So the World Bank and Asian Development Bank has really tried to shift away from a one-size-fits-all approach. They had some bad experiences with Afghanistan and Iraq, to name a few examples. And so they're looking at a couple of things. One is, of course, what are some financial transaction mechanisms that are going to be well accepted in certain countries? So that's one. The second was they wanted to actually unlock, commercially speaking, they wanted to unlock some capital. And they saw that a lot of Muslim countries wanted to transact in ways that are compliant with their population's faith. Indonesia being one of them, where Indonesia actually started working with the Asian Development Bank on financing a lot of infrastructure using Islamic financing mechanisms. So it was a commercial imperative there as well. And finally, in terms of the ethical aspect comes into play as well, particularly when there has been so much criticism of financialization. I mean, that's a whole nother literature area where people are concerned about why aren't you helping people with things that they need? Instead of just putting a lot of credit out there. I mean, we have those criticisms here in Australia as well with buy now, pay later, for example. So there was need to kind of think again and design new instruments.
How does Islamic financing support the UN Sustainable Development Goals? Is that another example of the neoliberal agenda trying to fit existing mechanisms, you know, within this new agenda? Or does it align quite well in terms of reducing poverty and reducing inequality?
Obviously, there are broadly lots of critiques about the United Nations system or the Sustainable Development Goals. In my humble opinion, I think that the latest set of the what's called now the Sustainable Development Goals or SDGs, basically for background, it replaced the Millennium Development Goals that ended in 2015. In my opinion, I think it's far more inclusive of different perspectives of the development process and far more encompassing of many other intersectional issues that are relevant, whether it be, I mean, the big thing is obviously climate, but also indigenous issues, gender, and also working with marginalized communities. And so within the Sustainable Development Goals, there is that broad agenda about trying to be more inclusive, achieve more sustainable development. So there is that alignment with a lot of the values of Islamic finance. But if we get more specific, goal number one and goal number 10, which is looking at inclusive development and also looking at how to work with other institutions to come up with shared partnerships, I think those elements naturally align. And so we're seeing some of the UN bodies also adopt Islamic finance in some of the other regions that they work in. For example, doing a lot of work with refugees out in the Middle East, or to be financing social and environmental projects. So there's a natural synergy between them. And I think part of the whole mandate of the UN SDGs is to let's just get everyone together. Let's just collaborate. Let's whatever resources, insights you have, let's bring it together. And I think there is a natural synergy there that can be further supported.
So your research looked at Indonesia and Bangladesh. And before we started recording, you were telling me a little bit about your confidence in the regulatory policy framework in Indonesia. Can you tell us a little bit more about your key findings in Indonesia and this regulatory policy framework?
Yeah, absolutely. To appreciate where Indonesia is today, we need to kind of look a little bit into history. And prior to 2000s, if I just look at the BMTs, as I mentioned earlier, which where most of Islamic microfinance happens, a lot of them were badly managed. There were significant fraud concerns throughout the whole sector. And there was early European research, particularly from Germany and the Netherlands, that looked at the sector. And they said, look, there's some serious problems. So no one would have taken it seriously. But over the last two decades, Indonesia's been going through a number of monumental political and economic processes. On the one hand, it's one of the fastest growing economies in the world, particularly off the back of the Asian financial crisis, where people almost wanted to write off Indonesia along with other countries. So we've had that happening. Along with another process, which was interesting for my thesis, which is a push towards localization and regionalization. And part of that was that the government started to promote programs like the single village programs, providing more local funding. And so taking the view that not everything has to be top down, that we can empower local communities. And Joko Wee, he founded a peak body called KNEKS, which was essentially set up to try and promote grassroots financing and development and co-opt other organizations, in particular a lot of his religious organizations, just because it was so prominent there. This was a complete departure from the early in the Suharto and earlier periods. And so within that, what we saw was when I went to meet with regulators, so I had some interviews. I mentioned I had interviews with the beneficiaries and the institutions, but I also met with the Financial Services Authority, OJK, and I met with the Ministry of Cooperatives. And what I saw that was really fascinating was that there was a real belief in collaborating with multiple stakeholders to try and make sure that the institutions were as robust as possible. And just to give a very practical example, so OJK regulation mandates that an institution that wants to get a certificate that they're compliant with Islamic financing principles, it mandates that their senior management must undergo Sharia compliance training, which is offered by the National Ulama Council. The National Ulama Council peak body has represented for multiple different religious organizations and also advises the government. So that's an example of a collaboration that's really happened. And in addition to that, there's been many other regulatory reforms, whether it be around financial reporting, around licensing and compliance, that's happening outside just the Islamic aspects. But that's really happened a lot in the last 10 years. And so it gives me confidence that, and again, as a law and development scholar in the purpose of my PhD, the regulatory compliance mechanism is absolutely key to achieve the outcome you want. There's no point coming up with a great design of a law if we can't implement it to achieve the objectives. And so I concluded that Indonesia was moving more rapidly in that domain compared to Bangladesh, whereas Bangladesh had started off a little bit ahead. In the early 2000s, they started regulating microfinance, but this sort of collaboration was falling away.
So I mentioned in the beginning that the majority of financial enterprises in Indonesia are small to medium enterprises. Is it true that 99% of SMEs, financial enterprises, are SMEs? I mean, that's incredible.
So it includes all enterprises. If you look at the statistics for Indonesia, they actually publish, it's really cool. Like, they have very detailed breakdowns. Yeah, 99% are in that segment, but that includes like your small cart, someone who's pushing a little cart and selling some mee goreng on the side street, all the way through to couple of hundred employees. So that sort of bracket is the majority of enterprises. We hear of in the news all the large organizations, but they actually make up only a small percentage of the total number of organizations.
So that 99% figure, is that assessed by the volume of capital that they're moving,
or it's just number of institutions?
It's still an amazing statistic. Yeah. So how can Islamic microfinance benefit these SMEs in a way that conventional financing initiatives can't? I mean, I think you sort of already touched on that.
Yeah, but for sure. So the access to capital is a major challenge for any organization, but particularly for a small organization that doesn't have either a lot of security that they can put up and that banks that okay, I can get confidence in you. They won't have financial reporting in the same way as larger organizations. So that's always a challenge. Obviously, what Islamic microfinance can do is that it brings a more diverse set of instruments to be more flexible. So for example, the most common type of debt from a bank would be, here's some money, you're going to pay back at this interest rate, regardless of what happens. Whereas in Islamic finance, and if I take examples from the micro space, there'll be a variety of contracts to meet different requirements. If a farmer wanted to borrow some money at the beginning of the planting season, they won't pay anything back until they've harvested and sold it to the market. And so that's an example of flexible contract. Or it'll be contracts based around leasing an asset that they will use. And so if that leased asset they don't no longer need or they're not able to utilize, they can return it back to the financier. There are many mechanisms out there that help them.
So these are some of the benefits. What about some of the limitations?
Yeah, so the biggest limitation, obviously, as I mentioned, is that the regulatory system for Islamic finance is playing catch up. There's still a while to go. So I mentioned earlier about the training program. So that's still primarily in the big cities. In the rural areas, it's still not as well trained and developed. The regulatory process is a massive bureaucratic exercise involving many different parties. So that's something that's going to be ongoing, and that it creates risk because it's a compliance risk. And also it raises questions of, are people misrepresenting their Islamic credentials to try and get clients and customers? So that's one. The other one is still a very small sector. Even for a country like Indonesia, Islamic banking and finance, it barely makes it to the double digits. In Bangladesh, it's a lot bigger. Malaysia, of course, is one of the largest. So what that means is that if you look at it from a whole system perspective, you're going to need qualified staff members. You're going to need access to capital and funding. You need institutional know-how. So it still will be playing catch up. But this is why Jokowi really took a top-down approach to try and promote it. And he saw it as an economic imperative.
Can I ask, how does it affect or how does it intersect with gender? Does it benefit men more than women? Are there targeted programs to increase women's participation in these initiatives?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are actually examples of women-focused institutions as well that operate. What I saw was there, depending on type of institution and depending on where they work, there are some local, so cultural and geographic factors that affect whether women are taking more than men. But in a country like Indonesia, which is an interesting contrast to Bangladesh, is that women are far more involved in economic life in Indonesia than in Bangladesh. And so the institutions that I had certainly interviewed, and I haven't got the national data per se, but I saw that there were women clients and they were borrowing for many different purposes, for both personal but also for commercial and business activities. So definitely there's no sort of gender barrier per se in access, but there are obviously cultural and geographic differences on what activities women participate in. I'll give one example. So in outside Surabaya, where I went to one of the Islamic rural banks that does microfinancing, they'll primarily work in the main market. And so a lot of those stalls were mainly run by men. There was only a few women. But then another institution was working in a more neighborhood area where the clients will live literally doors away from the institution's office. So we had a lot more women borrowers as well. So there's some differences there. In terms of the types of financing available, there is nothing theoretically about any difference from an Islamic law perspective. It's available for everyone. There's no particular issues there. But the one thing that the institutions are trying to get around is how do we adapt the product to be more supportive of women and their circumstances? And one particular institution that did a really good job of it was they actually reduced their pressure during the month of Ramadan because women had a bigger burden to play in Ramadan. They were preparing, for example, the evening meal to break fast. And so they couldn't go and run their shops at that time. So the institutions actually said, don't worry about paying this month. You can pay it back after Ramadan. So there are some attempts to accommodate.
We've talked about Islamic finance in the context of Indonesia, a majority Muslim country. What are the implications of your research for countries without entrenched Islamic law or for Muslim minority countries? Can secular frameworks support or benefit from the rollout of Islamic microfinance?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was actually one of the things I was really curious about is what are the elements that can make Islamic finance work in one country versus another? And actually, Bangladesh and Indonesia, although they're both Muslim majority countries, their political systems are really different. So Indonesia has a more secular constitutional framework than Bangladesh does. In Bangladesh, it's very overt, this is an Islamic state and so forth. In Indonesia, the policy pronouncements and the way that the regulators and the religious institutions operate is actually they take a very secular approach. What they say is we're doing nation building. Now, you can kind of look between that and go, is it really that case or not? But at least from an overt legal perspective, they are adopting that language and that sort of approach. So definitely there is scope to accommodate within secular frameworks. There are many other examples around the world where this does happen. So the United Kingdom is one very good example of that. Luxembourg is another country in Europe. The United Kingdom, for example, did launch its own government bond as an Islamic structure, which is called the Sukuk, and it's been very supportive. Australia, unfortunately, hasn't gone down the same path as the UK, but that's another issue. So yes, in a sense, it can. And where it's really relevant is it's about diversifying the financing structures that are available. That's number one. So you can have flexibility in how you pay and what's a mechanism to pay. The other aspect that's really relevant is the community building aspect. And I think that's something that was really inspiring for me about the Indonesian context, a little bit more than the Bangladesh context. Even though both had used group borrower kind of models, in Indonesia, the financing activity was often delivered by the same institution that also organized social gatherings, whether it be religious or cultural. They were also channeling charitable money. So, for example, one of the Baitul Mal Watan Wil that I studied in Surabaya called BMT Muda, they had members, FIA, and members who were less wealthy, and yet they're all living in the same neighborhood. They meet up, they know about each other's issues, they support each other for various different crises that might be the case. But also there's an element where they're depositing their money to get a financial return and the institution is lending that out to other clients. So I think that sort of community-based financing model is something that's picking up steam across the world, the mutual banking movement and sort of localization of finance. So I think there's elements of that that can be adopted. It doesn't necessarily require any sort of overt changes to law. Of course, there are some technical matters that need to be sorted out from a taxation perspective, perhaps, because if a financial institution is doing what's called a cost plus sale, so they buy from a vendor, then they sell it to the client, you don't want to attract taxation on both sides. So there are some nitty-gritty taxation details that need to be sorted out at some point. But I think that there's a lot, mainly the biggest thing is that it inspires a more human-centric financial system. And I think that's something that any country would be aspiring for.
Fantastic. What are you doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's actually two particular experiences with Indonesia, both linked, that helped inspire and actually make it practically to start Wholesome. So one was my first job outside Australia when I was sort of just a young graduate, still a young graduate, was to work with Indonesian coconut sugar farmers for the President Clinton Foundation. And that's where I saw how financial services was really key and how the existing systems can be very oppressive, particularly if they're in almost a long-term debt cycle with the farmer is with the trader that they sell to. So that was an experience many years ago. Then I went to do my fieldwork a few years later and I understood a lot more about, okay, how does the financial system work? How are the regulators trying to protect all the different stakeholders? And through that process, I also built a lot of networks. And when I came back, I was more confident that Indonesia is actually a country where we can invest. And by investing, we can actually do a lot of good. An ordinary person on the street, if you ask them, would you invest in Indonesia? They would probably look at you with funny eyes. Some of them may never even heard of Indonesia or didn't even understand how the Indonesian system works. So I was very much inspired and confident after that study that, okay, what have I learned from my PhD and what can I do with it? And that naturally was the next step that, okay, can I turn that idea about trying to help people in Indonesia into a product that I can sell to customers in Australia, essentially? And that became the genesis of Wholesome and the investment services that we provide. So we're a fund, essentially.
I like how I just need to point out that Wholesome is spelled Wholesum. Very clever. Don't know who you paid to come up with that name or if it was your own initiative, but it's very clever. It's very good. Now, I understand you also are still keeping a toe in academia. What are your current research plans?
Yeah, so one of the leading on from my PhD, one of the major gaps that I concluded with, and that was really, it comes up a lot in sort of both academic, but also in the private sector, is how do we measure the impact? Are we achieving the objectives we want on the ground? Are there potential harms as well that we need to understand better? And when I entered the private sector, these sort of questions have become a bit more prominent. There's a lot of, I guess, there's a lot of naysayers out there about, or pretty much on anything related to emerging markets or impact. And one of the things they say is, how are you measuring the impact? So I've recently teamed scholars in Hamad bin Khalifa University in Doha. One of my mentors who taught me Islamic finance, he's the director there, putting together a research grant application with Qatar Foundation. And we're collaborating with a few other scholars, including in Indonesia. We're trying to evaluate that if we increase financial services to these marginalized segments, particularly small and medium enterprises or microfinance, what is the impact of that? Can we try and quantify some of that? And can we understand the theory of change? If we can articulate that based on rigorous research, we'll be able to promote that sort of service amongst investors, asset managers, governments, and so forth. So that's something I'm working on and something I feel very much aligned with my work, but it's very much a continuation of that PhD research as well.
Well, good luck with the grant application and good luck with Wholesome, and huge thanks for coming along and speaking to us on SEAC Stories today.
Thank you so much, Natalie. It's been a pleasure to come back and talk to you, and yeah, had a really good time. Thank you.
You've been listening to SEAC Stories, brought to you by the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre at the University of Sydney. Make sure to keep up with all our SEAC Stories podcasts by following us on your favourite podcasting app. If you like the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, let your friends know about us on social media.